Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
The latest book by today's guest is a work of historical fiction based on a fictional character. Raymond Barnett is a magna cum laude graduate of Yale University, where he studied Chinese language and Chinese history. He studied theology for a year, then served in the U.S. Army in Vietnam. He earned a Ph.D. in evolutionary ecology from Duke University and for 30 years taught in the biology department at Chico State University. For his contributions in the founding of the Gateway Science Museum, the board proclaimed Ray Barnett Father of the Museum. He has now written his seventh book, The Death of Mycroft, Sherlock Holmes and the Secret of D-Day. Ray Barnett, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. Nice to be here.
Well, the title of your new book, The Death of Mycroft, I'm thinking people are probably scratching their Mycroft. That sounds familiar, and it's somehow related to Sherlock Holmes, but I'm not sure which character he was. Do you get that? Do people ask you about that?
I get a little bit of it. Most of the people I talk to are fans of Sherlock Holmes, and if you've read a fair number of the Sherlock Holmes stories, you will have encountered Mycroft, who was the smarter Holmes brother. He's only in four of the Conan Doyle short stories. So he's not a major character by any means, but a lot of people among those in the know about Sherlock Holmes are aware of him, although someone who's not read a lot of Holmes might not be aware of him.
Well, I have a picture in my mind based on the characters that I see on television in Sherlock Holmes films. And this is a very popular character for TV series. But you describe it, and none of the characters I remember playing Mycroft were portly.
Oh, yes.
And in your book, you describe him as portly.
Well, I go with the original description of him by Conan Doyle. And he was definitely portly and did not get around much at all. In fact, Sherlock, in one of the four stories in which he appears, says it's astonishing for him to get off his normal route of walking between the Diogenes Club to his office in Whitehall and then back to his lodgings. So he's definitely portly. It's probably more fun or exciting in the TV series and in the movies to make him a little different, which is okay.
So what you did with your novel is you took existing characters from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's series, his characters, combine them with real historical characters, and you create this story where they actually interact.
Well, yes, that's the fun of it. My very first novel, Jade and Fire, set in China at the time of the siege of Peking in 1948, was a historical fiction as well. And I just really enjoy the challenge of taking an historical matrix with historical characters and finding out all about them, and then putting my own fictional characters in them, in with that situation, and making everyone come out okay in the end, true to their historical selves and true to my vision of them as fictional characters. It's just a lot of fun, really.
Well, what I got a kick out of was that you're having the characters like Churchill, Winston Churchill, General Eisenhower, all these real characters. And then at one point, you pull in a character Holmes wants to work with, a character that Dorothy Sayers created.
Oh, yes. That's even more fun when you bring in a fictional character. I agree. Well, one of my favorite detectives is Dorothy Sayers' Lord Peter Wimsey.
Yes.
And I really like bringing him into my fictional universe as well. And in fact, in my next Sherlock Holmes novel, I bring in, I don't know if you know, the Amelia Peabody mystery series. It's a series by Elizabeth Peters about archaeologists in Egypt in 1923. And so I bring in Amelia Peabody and her husband in that as well. So I do love populating my fictional universes with not only historical but fictional characters as well.
My guest is Raymond Barnett, and he has a new novel, The Death of Mycroft, Sherlock Holmes and the Secret of D-Day. So you have this fictional character of Sherlock Holmes, whom we imagine is turn of the century, even 19th century character, and yet you have him meeting Winston Churchill, so he can't be a youngster.
That's correct. And that was another thing that was really intriguing about this novel, is what would Sherlock be like as an 89-year-old fellow? And it's not my conception of the Berkeley novelist Michael Chabon, who wrote Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay and many other books. He wrote a book called The Final Solution in the early 2000s, in which he had Sherlock still alive. I mean, this is a man who's taking royal jelly from that bees produce, and so it keeps him hale and hearty.
A longevity aid.
Exactly. And so I read Michael Chabon's, and it was just so fascinating to see Sherlock as a sort of a crotchety 89-year-old person that I thought to myself, well, geez, I wonder what Mycroft would be doing about this time. And I started thinking about that, and that was really the genesis of the novel.
Well, now, when you describe him as an 89-year-old, and we think of maybe an 89-year-old walking around kind of wobbly on a cane, but he gets into a game that is very popular in France, and he is putting this champion to shame.
Yes. Well, he is, as we already know from Sherlock, on the great hiatus when he disappeared after Reichenbach Falls and took essentially a 6 or 7 year vacation. He spent the last year of that researching coal tar derivatives in southern France. And in order to while away the time in between his laboratory researches, he took up pétanque, which is, you know.
Pétanque in the north. But the southerners added that extra syllable. Southern French has,
okay,
just like southern U.S., we have our own accent.
but we know from Conan Doyle that he took up the game in southern France during that time. So I also bowled a little. Just on a grassy surface in my backyard. So I thought it would be fun to have him secrete himself into Nazi-occupied France and have a game like this. And there's the purpose behind the game, as you're well aware, why he's there. He's trying to establish a motive for a crime. But it, again, was sort of fun. I have a lot of fun bringing in things that I like and things that I do and bring them into the novels and introducing other people to them.
Oh, I noticed that, how you weave in all your varied interests, because you I just mentioned a few of your varied things you've studied, but you also spend a lot of time outdoors.
Uh-huh.
You're quite the outdoorsman. And, of course, you know biology and sciences, and so you weave in information about plants and laboratories, and then your background in the Chinese history and language, and you have a character who
yes.
is Chinese,
yes.
and she's in the laboratory. And so just I turn the page, and I go, here's another interest that Ray has woven into this novel.
Yeah.
So I got a kick out of that. There was even a point, and I think Groucho Marx is the originator of this comment, that Sherlock Holmes walks into this house, and the doorman and the coachman, whoever he was,
oh, yes.
says, "Oh, Mr. Holmes, walk this way."
I couldn't resist that.
And Sherlock,
I think it was Groucho Marx, yes. And Sherlock says, "Well, maybe I won't walk quite that way."
Because the guy had kind of a limp, so yeah, no, I'm not going to walk that way. But so I noticed that. That reference, that nod to Groucho Marx's
yes.
comment
yes.
after the guy says, walk this way. Let's go to earlier in the book when you say you wondered yourself, well, what happened to Mycroft as Sherlock Holmes himself was older? And we are rather shocked that you open your book with, and the title says The Death of Mycroft, but I mean, you start right out.
Oh, yeah.
He's already dead. We don't even get to meet him at all.
Not really. I mean,
not in person, not in the flesh.
Yes, that's correct. You know, I'm sort of a classical detective mystery writer. You know, it's all about murder, Nancy. And why
that's
not?
Very British of you,
Ray. That's right. And so why not start off with the murder and then sort of work backwards from there? And that's, I mean, that's really the way Sherlock did in most of the Arthur Conan Doyle stories. He gets called in and there's a body and he has to figure out what happened to that body to get it there. And so I think I'm fairly inventive in many other ways, but in terms of the mystery, the structure of a mystery novel, I'm rather classical there, I believe. And so you're right. Very first scene, he's got a body to deal with, and it happens to be his brother, his smarter brother.
And he wants to know why his brother died, so he wants an autopsy done. And the authorities say, no, he's an old guy. He died of natural. He died of old age, for Pete's sake.
Yeah.
Give us a break.
Yeah.
And Sherlock is not going to accept that answer, so he makes an excuse to get a little bit of time alone with his brother's body, takes a blood sample.
Yeah, and he knows exactly where to get the blood. And it's interesting. Mycroft is dead, so he flips Mycroft's arm up and says, oh, my gosh. He's dead. The heart isn't pumping, so I can't get it out of the brachial artery. And so he plunges it straight into the thoracic cavity. So, and he's just from the very first, he's got emergencies and he has to think on his feet. And that's what Sherlock is so good at. And that's a lot of fun to put him in those situations.
Yeah, he's got to figure out, okay, how can I get some blood without this guy knowing that I'm doing this? And how can I check out this guy's boots to see if his boots are dirty? I've got to think up some ruse to get to look in his closet. And so he's always having to think up ways to get around maybe the rules.
Yeah.
So you have a couple of clues that he finds on his brother's body, which are?
Well, his brother is clutching a barnacle in his dead hand. Oh, that's interesting. He has no idea what that might mean. And then he notices it on his brother's bookshelf. A book is askew, and it's Charles Darwin's on the...
Which is unlike his brother.
Oh, yes. His brother's very orderly, and Charles Darwin's on the Origin of Coral Reefs, which Darwin wrote and which made Darwin's name. I mean, Darwin was in a fellow of the Royal Society of Science long before he even thought about evolution, and coral reefs made him his name, and orchids. And so he notices this, so he goes to the British Museum library, and he says, I need to find out about barnacles. And the librarian, who becomes a minor character in the book, says, oh, you want the Bible of barnacles then? And Sherlock says, oh, and who would have written that? And the lady says, oh, that was written by Charles Darwin. And so we get Darwin coming in from the very first two, which, of course, as a biologist,
I'm fascinated
with Darwin. And so we get Sherlock out to Darwin's home in Kent.
And you also have to be aware of a timeline, because you can't have anachronisms, because somebody who knows that that book wasn't out then. So
yeah,
you have
right.
to
sure.
keep in mind what was available to Sherlock at the time.
Yeah. And that's all part of the fun, bringing all this stuff together. One other thing I may mention that I found really fun about this novel. I mean, I'm 72 now, and it's different being 72 than being 52 even, much less 32 or whatever. And it's just interesting to me to write about Sherlock or another person, but particularly Sherlock Holmes as an older person. And I get to look at what's happening to me and my colleagues, and I get to extrapolate that a little bit forward at any rate and say, well, how would Sherlock deal with this? And so, I mean, this is not a book about being old by any means, but it was part of the fun of the book.
In fact, he sometimes uses as an excuse. Well,
yeah.
Excuse me, guys, but I need to, and then
yeah.
So you do take into account, well, this is an older guy, older character.
Yes,
for you.
Right.
We're talking about Sherlock Holmes, and he is the main character in a new book by Raymond Barnett, The Death of Mycroft. So Holmes goes to and looks up this book of Darwin, and in your book, too, you can get in references to all sorts of things that might interest you. You have an interest in Taoism, and so you get in a comment on Buddhism.
Oh, yes, right.
And what does Sherlock say about Buddhism?
Well, Sherlock does not. Buddhism leaves him rather cold. And I shouldn't say this because I have many good friends who are Buddhists, but Buddhism also leaves me rather cold. But someone says, oh, you in your hiatus that we mentioned before, you went to Lhasa and talked with the Dalai Lama, and you must have been very wise and been very excited about Buddhism. And Sherlock says, well, no, I mean, Buddhism's basic tenet is that life is all suffering, and that our goal is to escape the wheel of existence into nirvana. And that's not where I am. I'm a guy who loves life, and I want to partake of the good things in life. And so I'm much more inclined to one of the imminent religions, of which Taoism is one and Shintoism is another, for example. So yeah, it's another way to get an idea, a window into how Sherlock might be thinking about the world.
So he checks out, he looks at this book by Darwin, because he's got this barnacle he's got to figure yeah. out. And then he has to have the blood tested to find out what was in his brother's blood that might have caused him, because the doctor is saying, oh, yeah, this guy's an old guy, he died of old age. And Sherlock does not accept that answer. So what does he learn when he looks at his brother's blood?
Well, the body is a little bluish tint, which indicates asphyxia. And so that's what makes him think, oh, there's maybe something in the blood, a poison that might have brought this about. And so he's got the blood, and Darwin told him that it when he goes to Darwin's home in Kent, he finds a plant that his brother Mycroft has taken to Darwin's old greenhouse there, and it's a plant, Aconitum napellus, which is a source of a poison. It's called monk's hood, and it's a poison, an alkaloid called aconitum. And so Sherlock thinks, oh, Mycroft is trying to tell me that he might have been poisoned by this plant poison, aconitum. So he finds a test for aconitum, and he goes up to the best biochemistry lab in England, which I have visited, and on Tennis Road in Cambridge.
Tennis Court Road.
Tennis Court Road, thank you. And he has the lab technician there, who turns out to be an interesting relative of Sherlock's, actually.
That he didn't even know he had.
He didn't even know he had. Maybe we'll get to her later. But at any rate, so he tests it for this alkaloid, and he discovers, in fact, that this alkaloid, aconitum, was in the blood. And I have a friend of mine, a former student who is now a chemistry professor at Albion University, helped me with the test for alkaloids in blod and how you do it and everything, which was sort of fun to get that right as well.
And you know what? In this lab, Ray, I never thought I would hear the word beautiful describe a microscope.
Oh.
But at one point you say, a beautiful compound microscope.
Oh, well, yes. Oh, no. We scientists love our instruments. I mean, I'm a field ecologist, but I still love instruments. And yes, we do talk about them as being beautiful, and we fondly touch the titration tubes and the stopcocks of the titration element. So it's, yes, that's the way they talk. That's the way we do it.
So he was able to confirm that his brother was in fact murdered, and of course, if you have a murder, you have a mystery, and this mystery needs to be solved.
Yes.
So off he goes. My guest is Raymond Barnett, and his seventh book is a novel, The Death of Mycroft, Sherlock Holmes and the Secret of D-Day. So the fact that you mentioned D-Day in your title gives us a clue as to what point in history you're setting your character in. So here's an elderly, an 89-year-old detective, mm-hmm. Sherlock Holmes, and his quest to help out with D-Day. I'm kind of simplifying this. Takes him to France.
Yes.
And that's when he first says, well, Sir Peter Wimsey should go to France, but uh-huh. he's not available.
Yeah, that's right.
So off Sherlock Holmes goes, and he goes up and knocks on this door, this farmhouse, and he concocts this story as to why he's there. And the woman there says, well, the guy you need to talk to, Henri, is over in this nearby town because he's a boule champ. He's this outdoor bowling game that's so popular in France.
Yes.
He's there. So Sherlock Holmes makes an excuse to go meet Henri, and Henri's upset that the Germans, where is everybody? I need somebody to play boule with me. And Sherlock says, well, what about me? And he doesn't let on that he really knows how to play this game.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I mean, this is occupied France now. Of course, this is May of 1944. So he gets smuggled in one of the midget subs that the British used to investigate the various beaches that were under consideration for D-Day. And so he's there, but he's looking for a motive for his prime suspect, and the motive he thinks is hidden in France somewhere. And so he wants to find out all the personal information about his motive's life, his suspect's life. And the chambermaid happened to be married to Henri, and the chambermaid's dead now. So on the assumption that whatever the wife knows, the husband is liable to know it as well, he engages Henri in
flatters
this game.
Flatters him.
And pushes him to the very limit of this champion's boule game. But then finally lets him win, barely at the very end.
And I was going to ask you that because as you're reading, because you devote 10 pages to this one game, which takes not that long to play. They do play two games.
Yes.
And I was thinking, okay, Sherlock first, as he starts playing better, and you think, oh no, is Sherlock going to win? but that would not have been a good idea for the reason he was there. He needed to let Henri win so that Henri would be in a good mood.
Exactly.
Oh, my friend, let me buy you some wine.
Yes.
And then he keeps pouring the wine so Henri will reveal what he knows that he learned from his wife, Antoinette.
Yes.
And as I'm, because I just played boule myself 2 days ago.
Okay. Oh, really?
Yeah. And we call it pétanque because the people were there.
Yeah.
And everything you describe, I thought, that's so realistic that Ray must have played this game himself.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that it passed the Nancy Wigman test for pétanque or boule.
Now, I'm not an expert, but I just enjoy playing it.
Yeah. No, as I mentioned, I play the sort of children's version on grass on my backyard. But when my wife and I, the whole family actually was in Paris in 2008, we went to the Ile de la Cité, and they have some crushed granite grounds there, and we saw some people practicing their boule game. So I saw how it really works when you're playing it on a proper surface and the backhanded spin you put on the ball and everything. So I got a very nice lesson right there on it. And then, of course, I knew at least some of the rules from my backyard children's version of it. But it was, again, it was just a lot of fun to imagine a game where this champion is pushed so hard and then at the very end barely wins and is euphoric about it and eager to spill everything he knows to his opponent that he's just vanquished. So it was a lot of fun.
That was clever that you had Sherlock Holmes play this game and let the guy win so he'd get the information he needed. You mention in your book a couple of bomber barons.
Oh, yes.
And I was particularly interested in Air Marshal Harris because a friend here in Chico, that's his great uncle.
Small world.
It is a small world.
Yes.
And so you're talking about these bomber barons that play a role in your book. And how do you, when you made your choices about Winston Churchill, where did you come up with how you painted his picture?
Well, I read a couple of the biographies of Churchill and of Eisenhower and, of course, Stephen Ambrose's D-Day and everything. So, I mean, a lot of this is keyed to D-Day and the people bringing D-Day about. And so I took a look at Churchill from various angles, and he's a very well-studied person, obviously. And so I tried to make him exactly as close as I could get as to the way he actually was and all the various problems that poor man had. And one of them was with the bomber barons and your friend's great uncle, I suppose. And the bomber barons, Eisenhower wanted a lot of bombs dropped on the German lines the night before and maybe the day before D-Day. And the bomber barons were having a wonderful time bombing German cities, and that was not quite as exacting as bombing a railroad junction on the coast of France. In fact, they told Churchill and Eisenhower, you know, from 20,000 feet altitude, you cannot hit a railroad junction for sure. And so they were trying to wiggle out of it. And Eisenhower, I didn't know this before I read the biographies, Eisenhower at one point got so frustrated, he threatened to quit and go home to the United States of America.
Yeah, when I read that in your book, I thought, I'll bet this is true.
Oh, yes, it was.
Because it sounded like it was true, but I'd never known that either.
Well, Eisenhower was was adamant. He wanted the German lines softened up. He wanted some of the railroad junctions taken out so that the Germans couldn't rush troops and things to the defense of their beach fortifications. And the bomber barons steadfastly refused. And it took Eisenhower threatening to quit and convincing Churchill that he would, in fact, quit before Churchill and Eisenhower together just laid the ultimatum down to the bomber barons that you're going to have to do what Eisenhower wants you to do. And they did finally, at least for several days at any rate.
Well, you also, being a fan of Sherlock Holmes, you get in a way of writing a new ending to Hound of the Baskervilles. Do I have that right?
Oh, yes, right.
Because you have this trip that Sherlock makes, and you have an opportunity to get in some your own take on the Hound of the Baskervilles.
Well, it is my take. It's something I've noticed, but it's not just to me. For decades, Sherlock scholars and aficionados have noticed that there are some real holes in the Hound of the Baskerville story. Very relatively major stuff, and so this gives me an opportunity to bring that up and to bring about a new ending to the Hound of the Baskervilles, which is sort of fun.
The words you have Sherlock say are, it required two sessions to clear up loose ends.
Yeah,
story.
Right.
Well, it is so fun reading this book, and your take on, I know you did a lot of research, for example, Winston Churchill smoked cigars, but since Sherlock smoked a pipe, you had to study up on pipe smoking, for example. So I enjoyed the research that you did for this book. And we're going to take a break now. Thank you for this new book. But what I'd like to do is go back to a book that you wrote on the Chinese way of living known as Taoism. We referred to that a little bit earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And celebrate the autumnal equinox by hearing a review of a rebroadcast of your interview, Relax, You're Already Home.
Wonderful.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Raymond Barnett spent a year studying the history of religions at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. After serving in the U.S. Army in Vietnam, he earned a Ph.D. in biology from Duke University and taught biology at Chico State for over 30 years. He was instrumental in founding the Gateway Science Museum and was named the father of the museum by the museum board. During his biology career, he traveled in China, Japan, and Korea, and wrote an historical novel, Jade and Fire. Next, he wrote a Taoist primer, Relax, You're Already Home, Everyday Taoist Habits for a Richer Life. Since his retirement in 2003, he has written a thriller set in the future called The China Ultimatum, and a novel set in the 18th century Cuba, The Return to Treasure Island. Ray Barnett, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. Good to be here.
When you were at Yale, this was before, I mean, China was pretty closed off, and you couldn't go visit China. So how did you even decide, how did it occur to you that you wanted to study Chinese history and language?
Well, that's an interesting story. At Yale, I had a hole in my schedule in my sophomore year. I needed a class that met Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 11. And I looked through the schedule book and discovered not only was Chinese history offered, but they didn't require a term paper also, which was an added bonus. So I took Chinese history just merely because of the scheduling and fell in love with it very quickly.
And it makes sense that if you're going to study history and be able to pronounce the names and the words, that you'd want to study Chinese language.
Oh, certainly. It's a fascinating language, above and beyond any Western language, because just in the characters, there's a wealth of philosophy and culture embedded in the characters themselves. So it made it a lot more fun yet.
So you major in Chinese history and language, and then recently, you wrote a novel that it's set in 18th century Cuba, and yet it has a China connection.
Yeah,
how did you work that in?
Well, I wanted to write a sequel to Treasure Island involving Long John Silver and Jim Hawkins. My son and I had read the story together out loud to each other. And as we read the story, as we finished it, the Robert Louis Stevenson story, we wondered, well, geez, how did Long John Silver come to be a pirate in the first place? And what happened to him after he escaped from Squire Trelawney at the end of the book? So I decided it would be fun to write a sequel answering those questions. And because I'm just mad about China, it wouldn't be nearly as much fun to me if I didn't bring China in. So fortunately, back in the Ming Dynasty, the emperor who constructed the Forbidden City sent all over the world for rulers to come and help him inaugurate the Forbidden City. And then he sent them home again on a great fleet, an armada of huge ships. And according to Chinese history, those ships, since they were sailing to the ends of the earth, went ahead and sailed all around the earth. And there's some evidence presented in the book 1421 by a British fellow named Mackenzie's, that in fact a Chinese fleet called, or at least sailed through by Cuba and North America.
Well, now, I mentioned that you picked a country and study the history and language of a country you can't even, Americans couldn't even go visit. And now here you are writing a novel about another country that Americans can't go visit. But yet some Americans figure out a way to do that. So who is your source for information about Cuba?
I had an excellent source. My good friend, the late Rudy Giscombe, whom we all loved, had been to Cuba several times. In fact, once he even sailed in on a sailboat, which is the most neat, surreptitious way to get into a country, I think. And so it gave me an opportunity to have several long, delightful lunches with Rudy, where we talked a lot about Cuba and the Cuba approach to life. And he provided me with many maps and books about Cuba. So between Rudy's scintillating tales and my research, I was able, I think, to get a pretty good feel not only for Cuba, but what Cuba was like in 1756 as well, which makes it even more interesting to me.
Well, you know, you're not the only one who likes the book Treasure Island. I recently came across a quote. Some people were asked, what's your favorite summer read? It happened to be summer. And this woman said, I recently picked up Treasure Island again and found it's full of remarkably sophisticated prose. And what made us decide in our era that children's literature should be written for children?
Exactly. It's a wonderful book. Its only failing is it has nary a female character, just a whisper of Jim Hawkins' mother.
So you could fix that problem
exactly.
In your book.
Exactly. I very much, two of my strongest characters are two 15-year-old orphan girls, and it was a lot of fun. I have three daughters myself. It was a lot of fun to put all my hard-earned lessons about young women into the book.
My guest is Ray Barnett, and we're talking about, he wrote a novel, The Return to Treasure Island, and we're talking about this novel, and the first chapter takes place in Shanghai in 1756, and then the second chapter is taking place in England in 1756, and that gives you a chance to have Long John Silver come into the story. Why don't you read a little bit of that chapter two that's taking place in England? Ray?
Okay, Nancy. This is from Chapter 2, and Jim Hawkins, who's been left behind to take care of the Benbow Inn by his mother, who's taken his share of the original treasure and gone to London with Dr. Livesey with it. Anyway, Jim hears a thunderous knock on the door and in the midst of a storm, and he opens it. There he stood, the grizzled old buccaneer himself, looming over me in the storm. Water streamed off Long John Silver's greatcoat, his tricorner hat barely protecting his large, crafty face from the pelting rain. Even in the storm, he swept off the hat grandly, smiled broadly at me, too broadly, and bowed. "By the powers, my boy, you look good. Have you a glass of rum for an old shipmate, lad, whilst we parley over a scheme of mine?" My feelings for Long John Silver were by no means as warm as the apparent smile he was presenting me. I motioned him to enter with a jerk of my head. "Ah, thank you, Jim Hawkins. You always was a kind boy to my thinking," said he, hobbling into the parlor. He threw his drenched greatcoat and tri-corner hat over a chair beside the fire, before which he leaned on his crutch, rubbing his hands together. "The old claws get numb from cold much faster these days, my lad," he announced cheerfully over his shoulder to me.
This is Ray Barnett reading from his novel, The Return to Treasure Island. And Ray, it made me smile. The whole time you were reading that, I had this big smile on my face. That is so much fun.
Oh, isn't it? It was fun to write Long John Silver, but it was fun to research it and to actually made lists of his favorite oaths and asides from the original Treasure Island. And they put sentences together a bit differently in those days. Instead of "he said," it was often "said he." Mm-hmm. And so it was a lot of fun to get into Long John Silver.
And keep the character consistent from the Long John Silver people knew from the original novel.
Exactly, yes.
What fun. Well, speaking of fun, your other book that I wanted to talk to you about, the book on Taoism, called Relax, You're Already Home. And fun isn't missing from that book.
No, I hope not.
The Taoists have a sense of humor.
Oh, most definitely.
So if you were following this Taoist way of life, how would you incorporate fun? What do you suggest to people that they do to make sure they don't get too serious about life?
Oh, well, all sorts of things that I cover in the book. But Taoism, of course, is dedicated to preserving and enhancing the zest in life, the mysterious side of life. The Taoists, the Confucians, were interested in following the rules and being a good citizen and all that stuff. The Taoists quite avowedly thought that was rather dull. And so they just loved to, many of them, of course, would party a lot and drink and things like that. But that was by no means the only way they did it. They spent a lot of time in the natural world. And out in nature, of course, you can hoop and holler and you can float down rapids screaming as you go. You can be in around a campfire. I just came back from 2 weeks in the High Sierras. You can be around a campfire where you sing and you recite poetry. Just being outdoors makes Taoists really happy. And they would say that's because the Tao, this force that confers the pattern and the zest to life, flows very strongly in the natural world. So Taoists have a lot of time outdoors where they feel uninhibited. They have a lot of parties. They celebrate practically anything that comes along. And many sinologists have remarked upon the fact that in China there are festivals and celebrations very frequently throughout the Chinese calendar. And so they find excuses to celebrate the zest of life and the mysteriousness and the happiness of life.
You have suggestions in your book for modern-day Westerners and ways in which they can have a little fun. You suggest maybe getting a crazy hat to wear.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I like that one.
Yes, right. Wearing crazy hats and and also just picking out someone that to you is a model for enjoying the zest in life and having a party on their birthday, for example. So for the last several years, I have a party on Elvis Presley's birthday. And we play Elvis all day long and we get together and dance a little at night. I also am quite fond of Thomas Jefferson, who in many ways was a Taoist. He's a scientist, is interested in the natural world and very involved in life, of course. And so I'd have friends over on Jefferson's birthday, and we'd drink some of his favorite rum from the West Indies and read a little bit of his writings. So pick a person that to you makes you smile, makes you happy, and celebrate that person on their birthday or at some other appropriate time. That's one way you could do it at any rate.
Yeah, I think any day you can find something to celebrate.
I should think so.
So that was a suggestion you have for people to bring a little fun into life. You know, I thought it was interesting that the Taoists thought, too, that if you work too hard, that takes up time that you can't be carefree. And there was a quote in your book. You say the texts mentioning prohibition of grains. So that's a shock. But what? The Chinese not eating rice?
Yes,
how
right.
could anybody in China prohibit the use of grains? The text mentioning this prohibition of grains probably reflect an old Taoist dislike of the shift from a hunter-gatherer Paleolithic lifestyle to the daily grind of the agricultural lifestyle, which tends to blunt the carefree, celebratory approach to life so important in Taoism.
Oh, yes. Taoism is a very ancient approach to life, Nancy. It is a rather high philosophy for intellectuals. It's also a religion for the people, the folk religion, and everything in between. But it has its roots clear back in the Paleolithic with sorceresses and shamans and things like that. And so the Taoist philosophy of life was being developed before people had to worry about crops and rain and famines and things like this so much. And so the Paleolithic lifestyle, which is being in some ways rediscovered and celebrated today with Paleolithic diets and things like that.
For different reasons, people are saying, yeah, that's a good idea.
That's a good
Don't
idea.
Eat grains.
Yes, right. Well, the Taoism approach to life, it coalesced before the agricultural revolution, indeed before the Iron Age even, and so that they retain not only tellingly a empathy for the natural world and an ease in the natural world and a love for being out in the natural world, but they also retain a lot of the ease and comfortable of what we would today call a laid-back lifestyle before people got used to either agriculture and all of its unremitting demands, or even way before the 9-to-5 job, of course, with a 2 weeks or 3 weeks off for vacation. That's very alien to them, and they think we shouldn't put up with it any more than we absolutely have to at any rate.
My guest is Ray Barnett. We're talking about his book about Taoism called Relax, You're Already Home, and the Taoist point of view. You've mentioned that if you're a Taoist, you spend a lot of time in nature. But in 21st century America, right, I've got a job to do. I can't be going outside and sitting down under a tree.
Oh,
I've got
true.
Work to do.
Yeah, that's true.
But you're saying, do it anyway.
Yes, I'm saying find a way to do it anyway. And sit
or better yet, sit by a creek.
Sit by a creek. A Taoist love water. I mean, certainly there are weekends. Certainly there is before and after work. Certainly there is your lunch hour. I was fortunate enough to have a profession, a biology professor, where I could take field trips and be outside and get paid for it. Not everyone is that lucky, I will admit. But if you do put your mind to it, and this is something that's important enough to Taoists that they say, well, of course you'll put your mind to it, then you can get out before, after, on your lunch hour, on weekends, and maybe even growing up, find a vocation that will give you a little bit more freedom to celebrate life rather than being inside a boxy room for 40 hours a week or more. So Taoists, on the one hand, they're very serious about arranging their lives so that they can have a rich, full, zesty life. And so they'll make it happen.
So you have practical tips. You say, for example, get yourself a mountain bike.
Yes.
So you can spend time outdoors. Go out yeah. riding your bike
yes.
outdoors. And what are some of the other suggestions? Well, another suggestion, you say make a list of relaxing habits.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll bet, and it's sad to say, but I'll bet there are a lot of Americans who, if you ask them to do that, they couldn't come up with anything because they're too focused, so focused on work that they don't, well, let's see. Or relaxing habits? What would I like to do if I were to relax?
Yeah, that's a shame too, isn't it? We just take work much too seriously in this country. And it's funny, we go to other countries. I have a good friend who went to Africa for a while, and he said, boy, people in Africa, they laugh at Americans because we work so hard. And even in Europe, people don't work nearly as hard as we do here. But yeah, you should be aware of what it, of what you enjoy relaxing into. For some folks, for me, I enjoy making tea in the morning and in the afternoons, and sitting down with my tea and just, well, maybe just looking out my back porch or maybe with a book. I love taking a walk around the block or in the park or something like that. I like to get on my bike. I'm in my 60s, but I, in some ways, have never grown up. I just like to get on my bike and ride my bike and have the scenery whiz by me. I very much enjoy that as well. I enjoy gardening. And in these days, I guess it's not good to love to have a hose in your hand and just squirt water, because that's, I guess, we try to conserve water better, and I guess I try myself. But I love watering and watering my garden and pulling weeds. And this is just my stuff that I enjoy doing, but I arrange it so that I get to do these every day, really.
And you mentioned gardening, and that puts you in touch with what is the season, so that you're not locked up indoors not knowing, is it hot outside or cold outside? Or because I'll wear the same clothes year-round, because it doesn't matter. I'm in an air-conditioned or a heated building, so I don't have to worry about the way I dress or the kinds of activities or the kinds of foods I eat. And you suggest that people make consider, what are my favorite hot weather foods?
Yeah.
What are my favorite activities to do in a particular time of year?
Yes, I mean, we are hardwired to experience different seasons and different temperatures, for example. We weren't always inside homes that were between 68 and 72 degrees 24/7. And so it's part of what our bodies, our physiologies expect. And you're healthier, in fact, and happier if you're warmer in the summer and you wear fewer clothes. You're healthier and happier if you get a little chilly in the winter and you bundle up and eat soup instead of drinking lemonade. And so our seasons are part of what our bodies are used to, or what our minds are used to experiencing. And if you don't experience that, then you're a little, off-center, a little unfocused. And so a Taoist would revel in each season and the different foods in each season, the different amount of clothes you wear in each season, the different kind of sports and activities you take part in each season. That's good. We want to preserve that and keep doing that.
And to celebrate the change of seasons, we were speaking earlier about having fun and using any excuse to celebrate. And the change of season, the equinox and the solstice, is a perfect time to celebrate.
Of course. And they were high holidays in traditional China. And even today, when the solstices and equinoxes come around, my family and I put together our ancestor table in our front room, and we put pictures of our ancestors on it. And for the couple of days before the equinox and a couple of days after, for example, I gather the kids around, and my wife and I, Tammy and I, and we talk about our ancestors, and the kids get to know where they came from and some of the funny quirks about their ancestors. And it's just very enjoyable. And above and beyond this, it makes us aware that, well, gosh, the equinox is coming up. In the vernal equinox, at any rate, the days, in fact, are getting shorter. And we've been noticing that, and we notice that we've been noticing that. And we sort of consciously start to pull back a little from all the activity and all the energetics of the summer. And we're coming into fall now, and there's a different set of activities and a different approach to the world that's appropriate for the fall and for the winter. And the solstices and equinoxes remind us sort of where we are in the cycle of things, and it helps us fit in better.
So you recommend that we celebrate these changes in the season, times of year, and the Chinese certainly celebrate New Year's, but we Americans, since we have a solar calendar, we go by a solar calendar, we don't even know what the moon is doing. Probably if you would ask somebody, when's the next full moon, they probably wouldn't know. So we certainly don't know when the lunar New Year is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's easily remedied, of course. You can buy a farmer's almanac and take a look on the almanac when the new moon is that falls between, I believe it's January 22nd and February 22nd. That's that first new moon, which is when you don't see the moon, of course, is the start of the Lunar New Year. And it, for the Chinese, that started, of course, a two-week celebration that culminates in the full moon usually early February. And this is getting close to spring coming, and it's just a completely appropriate time to celebrate getting out of winter. Because I mean, you respect winter, and you do the appropriate things for winter, but really you're awfully glad to see spring get here. And so that's a perfect time to celebrate, and the Chinese do celebrate it. And we put up Lunar New Year celebration motifs and hangings around our home, and we have the neighbors over, and we bring in some Chinese food, and we ourselves celebrate the Lunar New Year just to remind ourselves that, wow, we're getting going on a whole new cycle going around the sun now.
My guest is Ray Barnett. We're talking about his book, Relax, You're Already Home, Everyday Taoist Habits for a Richer Life. And you mentioned that one way you celebrate is to put out pictures of your ancestors. And some people, you hear, well, the Chinese practice ancestor worship. Does that reflect a misunderstanding of this culture?
It does, really. Religion is so different in China than it is in the West. In China, it's more of a lived experience. And they certainly they are very cognizant of the fact that their ancestors connect them to the past, and their descendants, their kids, will connect them to the future. And they want to show respect for the ancestors. And so in traditional China, there was always open the ancestor altar with tablets representing the ancestors, and they would burn incense and in front of this altar. And Westerners came in and said, oh, you're burning incense in front of this. You must be worshiping the ancestors, which is not the case. It's ancestor reverence is the term I use. And I think that is completely appropriate to show reverence for your ancestors. Even if your mom and dad were not perfect moms and dads, according to what we think of as a perfect mom and dad in California these days, even if they had rough edges, boy, just being a parent and bringing you into life and getting you to adulthood is an achievement, I think. And so you're not pretending that your mom and dad or your grandpa and grandma were perfect people, but you're showing your respect and appreciation for their handing you the gift of life. And I think that is that's quite appropriate in any culture.
Now, you mentioned putting these, and you used the word altar, and I think people associate altar with religion. But yet, the way you present it is that you encourage people to create a space where they put objects, and you ask, if you take a walk, if you take a trip, or you go out in outdoors, what kind of object, what natural object do you like to bring back? And I have a little table at home, and one is a tiny little bird's nest that is so perfect and just amazes me.
Lovely.
But it reminds me of a friend who was with me when I found this bird's nest. And then I have a tiny little pine cone. So I have a table, but these things remind me of friends. And some remind me of friends who are no longer here. And so I like this idea that you say create this space, and maybe people don't like to use the word altar, but a place where there are objects that that you treasure and cherish.
That's
so that's
perfect.
Another suggestion.
You have a perfect altar there. And if you don't want to call it an altar, that's fine. I mean, Taoists are the least proselytizing people in the world. You can call it whatever you want, or you can just call it your special place, a place where you remember this good friend of yours. That's perfect. But what is important is, I think, that we encourage people to have those places around their house and to have those mementos of life, of richly lived life. And we could all use reminders, couldn't we? We get so busy. And we put these altars or these special places not back in the spare bedroom or a special room. We like to put it in the kitchen or the dining room or the front room where you actually see this during the day, and you're reminded that, oh, yeah, life is for living. Life is for zestiness. Life is for celebration. And so that's what these special places are for, really.
Well, now, you have a section of your book where you discuss the implications. If we feel that all of us should be out in nature, we should be in touch with the seasons, but there is a population, and it's growing all the time, that is impossible. And from a Taoist point of view, our prison system really has it all wrong.
It's quite bizarre. In the Taoist point of view, humans certainly can get off center and they get twisted. I use the phrase bent out of shape.
Or nudged off center.
Nudged off center, thank you. If they don't take care of themselves, if they let stresses build up, if they pay too much attention to all the human worries and not enough attention to the natural world. And so they become bent out of shape. They do bad things, and it's appropriate that we would want to remove them. But then we remove them to a place that bends them even further out of shape, that keeps them in these little rooms for 20 years at a time. And then when they leave prison, we're surprised that they're still doing mean things. The recidivism rate in California is 70%. 7 out of 10 people within 3 years go back to prison. So that tells a Taoist, you know, we ought to rethink this, and we ought to be more intelligent and more human about how we treat people when we send them off to prison for our own self-interest as well as for theirs as well.
My guest is Ray Barnett. We're talking about his book, Relax, You're Already Home, Everyday Taoist Habits for a Richer Life. And you mentioned a couple of Taoist truths. And one of them is, we're already what we were meant to be. And that's reflected in your title, Relax, You're Already Home. So you say that one of the truths is, we're already what we're meant to be.
Yes, from the Taoist perspective, there's nothing dramatically broken about human beings. Certainly, we can get stressed out. Certainly, if you have enough stresses and enough high energy inputs shoving you away from your center, very bad people can be produced. But at base, we are at home, and so we just need to relax into who we are. And the Taoist habits help us do that. They help us keep on center and focused and keep from getting too far out of focus.
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of people, in particular in California, that this, what you've been saying, really meshes with the way they feel they want to be living their life. And maybe they just need a little encouragement in the form of your book to show them, yes, this is possible. No matter how busy you think you are, just start looking at life from the Taoist perspective and see how you might find little ways you could change. And your book is full of suggestions for practical changes they could make.
Well, I will certainly second that. I think it would be great if we did that.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Ray, about your books. A couple of your books, The Return to Treasure Island and Relax, You're Already Home. Thank you.
You're welcome, Nancy. It was nice to be here.
You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, kcho.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.